Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. In today's episode, we hear from English poet Holly McNish, who talked to me about her new book, Slug and Other Things. She also recited two of the poems, and here is a little taster.
This is your fault, Granny, that I'm like this. I cannot leave the tiny shampoo bottle in the hotel shower, which I do not need to take. I do not need to take it. It will just sit in my bathroom cupboard unused for years, but I cannot leave it. Or the shower gel, or the body lotion. I don't even use body lotion. I've never used body lotion. This is your fault, Grandma.
We'll hear more from the brilliant Holly McNish in a moment, but today it's a big day today. It's the beginning of the phased reopening, a week of hugs and haircuts and whatever you're having yourself. So I hope you enjoy doing some of the things you haven't been able to do for the past several months. I managed to bag a hair appointment on Friday, so that's going to be the highlight of the week. Lots of highlights will be happening, and maybe some layers, and definitely a nice curly blow dry. But thanks to every single one of you who joined us for the recording of our 500th episode. It was a really special occasion, and we'll be bringing you an edited version on Thursday's episode, which is our 500th. So I hope you enjoy that. Now, Holly McNish writes about so much of what it means to be a woman. In her latest book, Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate, she writes about death and grief, growing up in periods, parenting, her relationship with her body, masturbation and lots more. The book is a mixture of poetry, prose, short stories and essays. It's not your usual poetry book, and it's all the better for that. She spoke to me about her life and career, women's bodies and her amazing grandmothers, also about her posh Cambridge education and growing up in the same village as Kate Middleton. Holly also performs two brilliant poems from Slug, which is published in Ireland this week. Here she is, Holly McNish. Holly, thank you so much for joining us on the Women's Podcast. Tell me about the title of your book, because it's intriguing.
Thanks for having me. It's very lovely to be here.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, so the title is Slug and Other Things I've Been Told to Hate. And basically, the reason it's called Slug is because that is one of the things that I've been told to hate the most in my life. Just these little creatures minding their own business, eating people's lettuces, you know. And the whole book's about things that I've been, well, sort of self-explanatory in that way, things I've been told to hate, or things I've been told to not to talk about, or to be embarrassed about or ashamed of. So it's all different things probably that my like family would rather I didn't write about, so I've just chosen specifically to write about all of those. I was trying to pick a word that kind of summed it up for me, and slug really, really sums it up for me. After this obviously sounds a bit odd, but I saw a film of two slugs having sex. So, and the way they had sex was so amazing and so beautiful. Like, it's amazing. And, not that I was watching for ages, but I thought, oh, these, I've been told in my life, these little creatures.
Sorry, is this like slug porn? Is basically
it's,
what you're
it was a nature. It was a short film at an Edinburgh gig called Noiriki, and they do like they have poets and musicians, and then short films as well. And there was a film of these slugs having sex, but they were like wrap their bodies around each other and like hang from their own spit off trees and stuff. Like, it's really acrobatic and amazing. But I thought, God, all I've known about these creatures is that they're like gross, like so gross. And then I thought, actually, a lot of the stuff that's gross about slugs, it's like the wetness and the muscle and the quite like a tongue. And then yeah, so lots of things like that. I like the word. I think slug, I like slugging back a drink. It sounds a bit like snog, which is another word that I really like. So yeah, it sort of summed up for me the idea of things that we're meant to find disgusting or taboo, but which are maybe actually quite beautiful, unless you do have a lettuce garden, in which case you probably still hate slugs.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I was just on Twitter earlier and I saw something that I thought it couldn't be real. One of those things you think is a joke, but there's three German men who have come up with a startup business called Pinky Glove. Have you heard of it, Holly?
No.
Pinky glove is a glove that they've come up with a solution to a problem that they thought existed for women, in that women don't like to touch their period blood. So this pinky glove is a glove that women can wear when they have to remove a tampon and do things. And it's a real thing, and they are getting torn apart on social media for it. So it just when you spoke about the slug and the moistness and the wet and things that people find disgusting, isn't it incredible that these three German blokes thought that they would do this?
That's amazing. Do you know, that's pretty similar to, I was, another title for the book was maybe going to be like, I don't think it's as good, but like Toilet Dolly, because that was another thing at my, I don't know if my grandma had like a little dolly with a long woolen skirt that she put over the toilet roll, because that was shameful in her day to show that. So all that sort of stuff. That's amazing that someone's designing that like now. I would expect it on...
If you read the little description of the company, it's like, no, women no longer have to get their hands and infected by the bacteria on blood. And it is just the most bizarre and not bizarre, you know,
That's
thing. And
amazing.
The three men there with their pinky gloves thinking they've sorting us out, helping us.
That's
this terrible
amazing.
Thing.
Amazing. Have they got a blindfold as well for when we take it out and then we have to look at the blood so we can't see it either?
There's probably pinky blindfold, pinky everything. Like. But anyway, I think their business is well and truly has been, you know, finished before it began, because everyone on the whole of the internet is just going, you morons.
That's amazing. It's
brilliant.
Also, pinky, I thought of penis, because it's in England quite often the penis, but in Scotland I know it's the little finger. My mum had quite a lot of problems with that when she moved from Scotland to England. As a nurse, she used to write down pinky, and then the other nurse thought it was about penis. I wasn't sure where we were going with the pinky glove.
Well, that's maybe that's what they were thinking of. But look, you know, I think it's a very good way to start this conversation, because you do write about everything, you know, periods, masturbation. You know, you don't leave any stone unturned when it comes to kind of a woman's body, a woman's existence. And that's kind of where you're coming from with the title as well.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel inhibited at all? Or is your whole work about just letting everything out?
No, I do feel inhibited. Definitely. So I didn't set out at all to write this book. So it's a book which comes from all the poems that I've already written. So it's like a way of putting the poems into a book. So these poems were done, like I didn't write them for the book. And there's another book coming out after, because there was like twice as many poems as this book. So it's sort of, there's another one as well about things that I've learned to love, about more positive things like friendship, oral sex is in that one. But yeah, so I just realised that there were a lot of things.
We will be talking about blood clots later, don't worry.
I just realised there were loads of poems that I'd written that I was actually a bit scared to share, exactly for that reason. Like, I'm definitely not from a background where we're very open, like not totally not open about it. And I feel like that's like a privileged position that I've got, that I can publish poems like this, I guess, poems about periods or about masturbation. And don't get me wrong, it'll embarrass people around me and my family, but not so much in a way that another writer probably couldn't even publish them without kind of getting ejected from their family or something like that. So I feel like I'm in a, like, you know, my dad will like roll his eyes and be like, oh Lord, but he wouldn't not talk to me for it. So it was just what I was writing about, because it's such a daily thing or a weekly thing, a lot of the stuff I was writing about. The same with grief as well. Like, I know it's not as taboo in that way in terms of things like periods and masturbation, but it still is taboo, like the idea of crying or apologising for being sad and all that sort of stuff. It just made me more and more annoyed, as I think it does many people, that a lot of things that for me as a woman or as a person were really just like normal daily life and really positive. I guess like the masturbation one, I find the most shocking of all, that's still so shamed when it's so safe. And it's like nobody that you can harm doing it, like definitely doesn't turn you blind, as we used to tell people. And just thinking about it, just thinking about why I'm so queasy about this stuff, because I am queasy about it. And even like, I wrote this book sitting on my own at a desk. I didn't have to talk to anyone about it. I was reading other people's writing about it and, you know, reading or talking to strangers or researching. But the minute I now, you know, like this, come on a podcast and chat, it's still like, oof, now I'm going to like have to say the word masturbation and the word vulva. So I don't find it, I find it easier and easier. But the reason that I wanted to do it was because I was sort of questioning like why we find this stuff so hard to talk about.
I totally relate to that because I would be, you know, we do this podcast, we talk about all sorts of things, but I definitely have a little, queasy is a good word, kind of. I get a bit like, I can feel myself going red sometimes. Like I still have that hangover from all the stuff I suppose you're told or the messages you get. You can think you're so right on and all, got it all out there, but actually it's a bit embarrassing still in some ways.
Yeah, and it's annoying that you have to. Like a few people that are close to me, like family members, have said like, do you really have to write about this stuff, Holly? And it's like, well, I don't have to write about it, but this is the stuff I'm writing about because I just write poems when things come into my head. So this is obviously what I'm thinking about a lot at the minute. And it sort of annoys me because I think, well, I write about loads of stuff that I don't really share. But so this stuff, the idea of sharing it. So it's not really, do you have to write about it? It's like, do you really have to share these poems that you've written? And I sort of wish we didn't have to share poems that I'd written about periods of masturbation. I sort of wish that we lived in a place where I didn't really even think about it, to write about it. But until we do, then I won't stop sharing them, if that makes sense.
And Holly, that's it, isn't it? It's just, you know, the more people like you just put things out there, like in the very everyday way that we experience them, which, as you said, is everyday and normal. And there just needs to be more stuff out there to make it normal. Yeah. So that we don't have to be squeamish and embarrassed anymore, because it will just be
totally. People have been doing it. It's not, you know, the first round. Like I was reading Sharon Olds poetry yesterday when I could go into a bookshop very excitedly and bought.
You are lucky. You're very jealous. We're so lucky.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Don't have it.
Well, I don't know if it would be a good thing in the long run, but I bought a Sharon Olds book and she writes loads about these sorts of things. But I just think, the more people that do, the less we'll probably have to in the future, maybe. Or maybe we will, and there will be lots of beautiful poetry about things that...
Well, there's so much more to talk to you about, because you mentioned grief there, and it's really beautiful how you speak about it, and the book is dedicated to your grandmothers. And so we're going to talk about that. But I want to get an insight really into what makes a poet, because I find it really interesting. There's so many... I'm finding poetry very exciting at the moment, and something that I might have at school struggled with, reading various poems and poets that I was supposed to like, that I was supposed to understand, that I didn't really get. And in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, there's so many, particularly a lot of women coming up, writing stuff that I'm actually really engaging with. And I can imagine for younger people, it's a gateway into other sort of writers as well. But where do you feel like your poetic sensibilities were first sparked? Or when do you remember observing the world in that way first?
I think definitely just with funny kids' poems. Like every time I try and think about why, because I've written poems for years, I just love it. I really love it. And I never really know what makes a poem. I remember Simon Armitage said it's the way that it's laid out on the page. That's what differentiates poetry and prose, basically. So I'm not really sure, but definitely the first time was there's a poetry collection called Please Mrs. Butler, based in a school, and it's from like, there's loads of poems from teachers' points of view about these sort of moany kids. And there's one, Please Mrs. Butler, it's like this boy Derek Drew keeps copying my work, miss, what shall I do? And this teacher's just getting more and more annoyed. And I thought it was hilarious. I read that over and over again. And another one called Scissors. And it's like, nobody leave the room, everyone listen to me. And this teacher just blocking the kids in the primary school classroom until they'd like found all these scissors. So it was definitely that. Like I loved funny poetry when I was a kid. So I guess my mum like reading me them, and I've still got this little, I loved like those mini books you could get. I had like a mini library with like books about fairies, I think it was. And then this mini collection, I think it was like Roger McGough, Colin West and Alan Alberg, or Janet and Alan Alberg. And I had that by my bed, and there was one called Pie in the Sky by Roger McGough. And that's the first time I remember, it's like this guy complaining that there's a bit of sky in his pie, and taking it back, and he wanted ketchup, not like birds in the pie, and not, you know, the sunset and stuff. And that's the first, I think that's the first bit of sort of abstract thinking my brain ever did. That, and when somebody told me that the sun was actually just a star and that all the stars were a sun, that blew my mind as well. So that, and this like Roger McGough poem. So yeah, definitely at that age. But yeah, sky in the pie, I was like, wow, what an idea. So I think that's when I started writing.
Growing up, did you have a lot of books in the house? Was it a writerly kind of background?
Like, not like loads, but yeah, we had quite a few. Yeah, we had lots of books in the house. Like, my mum and dad both love reading. We didn't have a sort of house with a whole wall of like library, but we had like books in my mum and dad's bedroom and stuff. And my mum really likes poetry, really likes it. I didn't really realise she did until I kind of started publishing it, really. I've been sort of moanily reading my poems to her for years, and she'd never been like, it's all right, but can you read Ted Hughes? But so she definitely knew loads more about poetry than I knew she did and that she ever sort of let on. I grew up like being very encouraged to read, and I loved stories. Like Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was probably my favourite. I didn't really understand any of the religious references, but just, again, I guess the abstract thing, when I imagine people have all read it that are listening to this, but even then I'm not going to spoil the ending because that's the whole point of the book. But the ending of that, I was just in shock for days. I couldn't believe it. We had lots of books. But it wasn't like a literary family in that way. Nobody was like, my mum's the nurse and my dad worked in computing. But they read a lot and encouraged me to read a lot.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little village called Bucklebury, which is sort of half an hour outside Reading in the south of England. So,
it's not the place where Kate Middleton is from, is it?
You know what? None of us knew that, until we found out. So she's from it's a lovely village, but there's like a sort of normal estate area of the village, I guess. And then there's loads of woodland around it. So yeah, she's from, I think I have a Bucklebury, there's like Upper Bucklebury, Lower Bucklebury and Bucklebury. So I'm from Upper Bucklebury. And I think she's, I don't know how far away it is, but there's lots of like big sort of mansion houses like dotted in the forest. So she's from one of them. But yeah, it is. And the village that I was in when, like, my dad's not into the royal family at all. Like, my mum and dad are both from Glasgow, and they moved down about 5 years before I was born for my dad's job. But when the village found out that this Kate, I've now forgotten her second name.
Middleton. Lee, that's disgraceful.
I'm so sorry. I do know that.
I love that I'm an Irish person telling an English person what her second name.
I'm just not a fan of the royal family. And
I can tell.
It is disgraceful. My auntie is going to kill me. She will actually kill me if she is. It's really, she doesn't. But yeah, they like renamed the street just at the end of my road. Like, I think it's called Catherine Street now. And then they started selling, this was the exciting thing in my village when the wedding was going on. I wasn't there, but my dad kept phoning me up to say they were selling like royal jelly babies, like only at our village shop. And then the two people that work in the village shop were invited to the wedding, and they were like, she's never been in here. We know it's because we're like some of the only people that she's ever interacted with who aren't white, and that's why we've been invited to the wedding, but we're just going to take it and go. So it was just like, but yeah, the village, it was like suddenly everyone, you know, knew. My dad's like, oh yeah, she's such a nice girl. It's like, Dad, you have never seen her or met her. But yeah, it's like the uproar. So it was pretty funny, but yeah, she does. So I think must only be like 20 minutes away, I'm sure. Pretty close.
Isn't it funny that I knew that though, when you said Bucklebury, that I actually knew that. I'm kind of amazed, because her parents had this party favour business. They're really rich, I think, and they must live in a big mansion somewhere in Bucklebury.
Yeah.
But I remember hearing it, just thinking it was a lovely name for a place.
It's so Bucklebury. Nice. And it was in Lord of the Rings, Bucklebury Shire. So my dad's like obsessed with Lord of the Rings, and my brother's got the same birthday as Frodo, I think, and also grew up in Bucklebury. So yeah, that is the other claim to fame. Very nice.
But you left Bucklebury and you went, where did you go to study?
I went to Cambridge.
Now that's very posh, Holly, isn't it? Going to Cambridge University.
It's very posh. But it was very posh and it wasn't very posh. So I went from like the local state school, mixed comprehensive school there, and I went to King's College, which looks very posh and was very intimidating to go to, but it's sort of known as the more equal state school accepting college, which is why I was sort of told to apply there. It was like the only one where you don't have to wear gowns to dinner and where like the fellows don't sit separately. So I guess normal, it's not normal, but more normal than some of the other colleges. Yeah, sometimes I sort of skip over the Cambridge thing because I don't feel like I studied French and German. I didn't study English or poetry, and I feel like it shouldn't be given too much credit for that stuff. But actually, I'm pretty proud that I got in there, and I met some amazing people there. I found it weird being there, and I wouldn't say I enjoyed it that much, but it definitely taught me a lot. So yeah.
Would you say then, like coming from, I don't know how much of a huge achievement, or I don't want to over egg it, but coming from a state school, like did many people in your class have aspirations to end up in the likes of Oxford or Cambridge? Were you encouraged by teachers, or how did that even happen as an aspiration for you?
So we were encouraged. So I went to a school, it was a pretty, I'd say it was a good state school, but then I really liked it. So yeah, so it was in like a fairly affluent area, I reckon, in a place called Newbury, St. Bartholomew School. So yeah, but it was still like my name's on a plaque in the school still, like, and got, you know, for the people that got into Oxford. So it was like a big deal. I think we had one person, another girl get into Oxford and I got into Cambridge, and I think maybe six people applied. But yeah, so it was made into a massive deal by the school and for my parents. My mum, not less so in a bad way, but she's definitely less, she doesn't like pose about stuff like that. But my dad was like on the phone to everyone he'd ever met in his life to tell them sort of thing. So it was really nice. And the teachers, it was really nice. Like my German teacher gave me extra classes at lunchtime because he thought I had a chance of possibly getting in, but they were pretty funny. So it was like a sort of I was told to say, the main thing I remember from these classes is he said like you get interviews there and we don't really have many people going there, so we don't really know about it. So he said, what are you reading at the moment? That's a question that they often ask. And and he said, right, if they ask that, say you're reading Ulysses. It's a book by a guy called James Joyce. And I've never read it still. But that was, and my teacher said, say that because that'll impress them. And I was like, but I haven't read it. Like, what if they ask me questions about it? He was like, maybe you should read it. It's like, I don't want to read it. Like, I'm so struggling with all my work at the moment. I didn't want to do extra reading when I was, you know, it's really hard at school, isn't it? You've got loads of subjects. So yeah, I remember that. So there were lots of things like that were definitely not the most helpful, but then other things that were definitely very nice. But I did get asked that question, and
did you say Ulysses?
No, I didn't say Ulysses. I said, I think it depends on your interviewer as well. I think it's such a chance thing getting in. I hate it when people are arrogant about getting into certain unis because I think there's such a chance in it. And also loads of people I met there, and this is maybe going to be an awful thing to say, but that had gone to some of the like Eton sort of schools were definitely not smarter than my friends that were getting like B's and C's at my school. And that really, like, it just, the idea when somebody says that they've got a degree from so-and-so a university, I always want to know like a bit about the background, because I just don't think it means the same from certain places. Yeah, so I'm a bit skeptical about that, being like, oh, this is, she must be great because she went here. But yeah, I said I was reading Just 17 magazine in the interview.
Excellent.
Yeah, and said because I've worked,
I think that probably went in your favor.
I think it probably did. I said I worked really, really hard, but I don't want to read more like more difficult. I want to like relax after I'm working my ass off at school, basically. So I think it probably did. And knowing the person ended up being my tutor, so I think it probably, they probably had about 20 people said Ulysses.
The only person in the history of Cambridge University who answered that question by saying magazine. Yeah, I would almost put my life on it.
But I think, yeah, I think it was probably helpful to be a bit more honest. But my mum did take me shopping to buy like a Cambridge University outfit for the interview. So that was pretty funny. And when we got there, she was like, what have we done? Honestly, you don't wear polo necks. You don't, what, like, this is so ridiculous.
And you obviously had a, you sounds like you had a great time there, but did you come away with any, what observations about class and I suppose about the elitist nature of education in Britain I mean, we have private schools in Ireland, but I think it's a whole different ballgame in England particularly. And when you look at like who ends up running the country, you know, a lot of the times, as in the current crop, David Cameron, it's that kind of Bullingdon set, and it's the people in those colleges. I mean, what were your observations around class from going there?
So I found it fascinating, and I didn't, so I was quite clueless about a lot of stuff when I went there. Like I was very good at the subjects that I was studying, but my general knowledge was not good. Like we did a general studies exam for A-level, and that was like, I got 4 A's and a D, and I got a D in general studies. And not that that's a bad grade, I'm not saying, it was just, I knew a lot less about it than I did about like maths, is what I mean. And I didn't know there was a difference between like private schools and public schools. So I didn't know that like differential existed at all. And one of the things that I noticed when I got there, because I went to a state primary school, and then the last 2 years I got a scholarship to a local private school, which my mum and dad thought, great, this will be a great thing to put me in. And then I went back year seven in secondary school and sixth form back to like the local state comprehensive. And the one thing that amazed me when I got to Cambridge was that people asked what school you went to, as if like you'd know. So I found it really weird. I was thinking, this person, like, I know the five schools from my area because we played netball against them. Do you know what I mean? I know that Parkside are likely to dig their nails into us. And I know that, like, so stuff like that. So I found that really weird. And that didn't really happen at King's, because most people I knew went to state schools. So that wasn't really known. But I played lacrosse, and that was eye-opening. So my school was the only state school, I think, in the country that played lacrosse, because one of the PE teachers used to play and she set it up there. So when I was at school, it was amazing because we'd always play against these really posh schools. The away matches were brilliant. We'd have like really nice dinners. But so I joined the team. So I played for like the Cambridge University team at lacrosse. And that was, I ended up quitting after like a year and a half because I just couldn't handle the differences in that way. And they were like, oh, you know, what school did you go to? I was like, St. Bart's. I'm like, oh, haven't heard of that one. It's like, there are so many schools in the country. I just didn't get it. I didn't get there was this network. And so my close friends, that wasn't really an issue at all. But in the lacrosse team, I felt really out of it. And I'm not from a poor background. I'm from a very like standard middle class background, I think. And that, so my dad's brought me up thinking that we're absolutely minted. And I remember phoning him up being like, we're not, just to let you know, like, you're not as rich as you think you are. Like, it's very new money in my family, I think. And so that was quite funny. And like one of the things that was shocking on the lacrosse team, when we had the varsity match, as it's called, against Oxford, and we had to write down our addresses for, I can't remember, like health and safety, whatever it was. So we wrote down our addresses, and this girl on the team saw me writing mine down, and she was like, Oh my God, I've never met someone with a house number before. This is so exciting. And called people over to look at my address because I honestly did not get what they were saying until I looked at the rest of the addresses, and it was like the stables, the barn. It was all like things that sound like they're not posh, you know, a stable. It's like, well, my house is definitely better than a stable. So little things like that.
The outhouse.
Exactly. The barn, as if it's a barn. So that was quite funny. And my mum being a nurse, somebody was like, I've written about it, but somebody was like, oh, that's so cute. Oh my God, that's so cute. And people ask things at the lacrosse dinners where we was my like low point of being at Cambridge. And I used to get so drunk because I was so awkward, and my friends from college would like come and find me, and I just walk out these dinners halfway through. I was really kind of rude, I think, because I didn't really know how to cope with it. But they would sit, and I remember one dinner, like no one else went to a state school, and they all went to quite either public or very well-known private schools. And they were asking, like, what's it like going to school with common people? What's it like being poor? Like somebody said, what's it like being at Cambridge with such a common accent? It's like, how have you like got straight A's and you're so like not knowledgeable about anything in the world? So it was a flip up. My college friends and lots of them were really lovely, and it obviously taught me a lot in terms of the like academic side. But it was shocking. Like somebody wouldn't walk with me out of the college. I think that was a low point that I was friends with in college, and then she'd almost been asked into like the sort of, what was it, Bullinger equivalent club, at Cambridge by someone, and you had to be asked.
Bullingdon.
Yeah, you had to be asked by a boy from Eton, and she said, "Oh, do you mind if we don't walk? If you don't walk beside me when we like leave the college, because I'm almost in. But if I get seen walking like with someone, I guess from state school, then it would like scupper the chances." So stuff like that, just.
They're not your friend anymore.
No, it's hard not to be biased, though, because there was obviously loads of very wealthy and very posh people who were absolutely brilliant. And I am obviously, you know, wealthy and posh compared to a lot of other people. So it's I try not to sort of shudder every time I hear a sort of very posh English accent. Because
I want to get onto the book. Before I do, just give us a little summary of how you got into sort of spoken word first, then poetry, and, you know, a little trajectory of your career since leaving college.
So I left college when I was 21, and then I did a master's part-time. So I worked for a couple of years in a shop and a nightclub, and then did a master's in economics part-time. So I thought I wanted to go into economics, which obviously didn't happen. Very poetic. But then I've been writing a lot of poems for ages, but just kept them, which I still do. And I still really just like writing for myself. But it was, I think I was about 23. And my mum, who I'd been reading poems to for a long time, and a lot of them were very whingy, that sort of poem when you're like, think that you know about the world. So you write about it very confidently. So I'm quite glad that I didn't start reading out my poems until I was in like my mid-20s, because I think they might have been terrible. I'm sure that's what I'm going to think about my stuff now when I'm like 70, but that's fine. And then my daughter's dad, like, sort of encouraged me, not together anymore, but he encouraged me to read them to other people. And then so did my mum, just in the sense that, like, I was writing loads about, I guess, women's, I don't like the word issues really, but stuff to do with being a woman, that they thought might be helpful for other people to read. And I guess the fact that I was quite not confident in terms of on stage, of not being into acting or being into theatre or anything, but I'm not like a really shy person that would find it horrendous reading them out. So I went, when I was doing the Masters, I went past Covent Garden. There's like a wee poetry cafe in London, and it was in London that I was doing this Masters. So I went there a few times and sort of looked through the door, and then eventually went in after about a year, I think, and read a poem at this really welcoming poetry open mic night. But I had in my head that I just wanted to prove to myself that I could do it, because I kept like calling myself a chicken and writing really terrible poems about being a chicken, and what was the point of writing if you couldn't read them out to anyone? Like, really awful. The sort of poems about poetry, that's not really what I like reading. A poem about how I couldn't read out my poem, like, I can't think of anything more boring.
I write a column, and I've done it for years, but sometimes when you're staring the blank page, you know that bit where you're thinking, and I've taught it so many times, I'll just write a column about how hard it is to write a column, and I have to stop myself. It's, you know, who the hell would want to fucking read about you having writer's block? It's like the worst. So I get that completely.
Yeah. Maybe we just send it to each other. If you ever feel like you desperately need to share it. Yeah,
I will.
So I just went in and I thought, right, I'm just going to read it, prove that I can do it, and then not do it again. So it wasn't really I don't think it was in terms of like wanting anything big to happen out of it. But then at the first reading I did, I got asked to do another open mic night, which was a poetry slam, which I'd not heard of, being somebody that grew up in Bucklebury and not in a city. And so then I did it, and somebody asked me at that to do another one. So I sort of got asked at them. So it was pretty lucky, really. And then I made a deal that if I got asked to do one, then I'd do it. But if I didn't get asked, I wouldn't like just do it for the hell of it, because I felt really weird about like forcing my poems on people. I think poetry is funny because there's the sort of people that call themselves a poet, when I was growing up, wasn't always the people I got on with. Like somebody that would say, like, I am a poet. It was like, oh. So the idea of me thinking that like people needed to hear this stuff, or that I was like good enough to go and, you know, force my poetry on people that maybe didn't want to hear it, wasn't really something that I wanted to do. So then I made a pact that I would do it. But then I really sort of got into it and it kind of took off, I guess. But I was still working. I think my daughter was about 2 years old and I was working in an office job that I liked a lot, which was in like a youth charity, architects charity, about planning towns with like young people in mind. And I'd been there for about 6 years. And then I got offered like redundancy. So that was when I was already doing like enough workshops and gigs and stuff that it was kind of half and half with this job. So then went into it. But yeah, I've still got a bit of that in me. It's like, why are you doing this? And it's really nice sharing poetry. And I actually love it when other people share poetry. So it's fine. But there is still that like, don't get to that mentality where you think people like need it. I see that quite a lot of gigs where somebody gets given 10 minutes, but they, you know, do half an hour set because it's like the audience needs more sort of thing. So I just, that side of poetry, I cannot stand and I don't ever want to like be part of it. So I'm always quite wary, I think. But I do love it. I love sharing it and I love meeting people after. And I love hearing people read their poetry and reading other poetry. And I'm glad, obviously, people have shared. Otherwise, you'd not hear anything or read anything. So yeah, but it is a funny wee world, I think.
I think that's probably what keeps you, yeah, I think it's good. Always keep that attitude, I think. I mean, the idea of reading half an hour of poetry when you've only been asked for 10.
Oh, that's, it's happened a lot.
Shocking to me.
Oh, it's amazing. It's happened once. There was about seven of us. I think it was in Australia, but we each had a 5 minute slot at this opening. And, you know, obviously if you go over, you're also eating into other people's time. And one of the women were just like, no, I need to give them more. And just did 20 minutes. Oh. 20 minutes. Cut us all down to like, it's unreal. But yeah.
So you're now, I mean, you've a few books. I mean, the books obviously came, you got offers and people wanted to publish you, which must have been fantastic when that happened. I mean, how many books have you got now? How much is Slug?
I've got.
How much is Slug?
I mean, $14.99 from all good bookshops. Thank you very much for asking.
How many books have you got now, Holly McNish?
Five, I think. So, yeah, I've got a collection, Papers, Cherry Pie, Plum, and they're all straight poetry collections. And then Nobody Told Me, which is prose and poetry, and then Slug. And there's also a play. So I co-wrote a play about the history of UK women's football with Sabrina Mahfouz. But in all honesty, I wrote about 5% of it and she wrote about 95% of it, but very kindly put me on as a co-author. So I always feel like I should say it. But yeah, so it's five poetry books now.
Well, just going on to Slug, because and I know you started that with the last book as well. The prose is brilliant in it because I sometimes read poetry and I find like, okay, I have to sit now and think for a while about what was really going on with that poem. And sometimes I get it and sometimes I don't. But you've done these really beautiful sort of prose pieces as kind of, I suppose, like introductions or behind the scenes of the poem, I would say, in a way. And then you put the poem afterwards. And for me, it just gives a really glorious extra layer to what the poem is. And tell me about why you like doing that.
I'm so glad you said that, because I keep thinking, oof, I'm not sure if this is a good idea sometimes. Basically, for the same reasons that I guess you're giving, like if I read a poetry book, I spend half the time looking up stuff on the internet now, basically about the poet, or I'll watch like a YouTube video of them talking about the poem and then I'll read the poem. I just really like that. And I think not everybody does. Obviously, some people, they just want the poem. But if that's you, then you can just read the poems. Like there's an index of the poems and you can read them if you want. And I've put that at the beginning of the book. But I think Seamus Heaney is probably my biggest example of why I wanted to do it, because I love his poems now, and I did them in school, and I know that's often the case with people, but I really hated digging the poem when I did it in school and I didn't get given any background to it, or maybe I did and I didn't listen, so I'm not blaming the teacher here. I could easily have just been chatting with a friend instead of listening. But I just thought, oh, I don't care. I don't care about digging. Like, I don't care about potatoes. I don't care about this. I was really obnoxious little shit, I guess you might put it. And then after I read about him and watched stuff with him, then I went back to his poems and went to Magarafelt, I might have pronounced that wrong, but to do a gig.
Very good attempt.
Magra Felt. Yeah. Oh.
I'm probably getting it wrong now as well, Holly's.
I stayed in a B&B, which is just covered in Seamus Heaney's poems, and I did a gig at Seamus Heaney Centre and read loads, and I just loved it. But I wanted more. Like, I really want to know more about the poem. I think it's really interesting. And I guess doing a lot of live gigs, you get that from a live performance. Like, I watch as much poetry as I read, not at the moment with lockdown. And I love people chatting about the poem before. I really like hearing where they were or what they were thinking or what they were doing or how quickly they wrote it, anything. I love all those stories. So I wanted the poems to be a little bit embedded in what I was thinking at the time and maybe why I wrote them. So I'm really glad you did, because it does make it a bit of a
I'm just thinking about Midterm Break by Seamus Heaney, and that's a beautiful poem.
Amazing.
And you know, imagine that with a bit of prose as well.
Yeah.
About that whole scenario, you know.
Yeah, I think so. I think poetry sometimes exists in a bit of a vacuum, and I don't really want that for mine.
Well, yours doesn't now, and it's fantastic. So let's talk about your grandmothers, because the book is dedicated to them and to your mum.
Yeah.
And it's a lot about grieving and grief. And I think grandmother or grandparent grief is something, again, as well, we don't see an awful lot about it. Like, you're supposed to be okay. It's supposed to be like, oh, they're old anyway, and it's okay. But like, at one point in the book, you say, I'm not a grandchild anymore, like I'm nobody's grandchild. Like, I thought that was really, I hadn't thought of it, because I felt a bit jealous of you having those relationships, because I'm someone who on both sides just never had that experience.
Yeah.
Two of my grandparents were in London, because my mum's from England, and then the other two, the grandmother was dead long before, and then the grandfather just was a bit of a distant character.
Okay,
so
yeah.
You know, the fact that you had these two really important relationships, and that when they were gone there was so much in you to express about that, was really beautiful to read. Tell me about them.
Wow, they were just amazing. I definitely feel like they would have both hated this book. Like, my grannies would have really, really not liked the fact that I wrote about this stuff, but they would also sort of liked it and hated it at the same time. So I find it a bit funny dedicating it to them, because they would have, I can imagine them rolling their eyes, being like, oh, Holly, like, do you have to? Like, my mum is, do you have to? But my grands would be like, do you have to? You're going to get, you know, ejected from the village if you write these poems. But they were both really different, actually. I think that's why I learned. So my granddad's died longer ago, so I spent more time with my grannies than anybody else. But they were just so open to chat, which is amazing. And I know lots of people don't have that. And my gran, especially my mum's mum that I talk to, well, I say a lot in the book that I talk to a lot about sex, but about sort of pleasure and all of those taboo stuff and how it affected her life so much. And seeing it, I had such a nice time in life, and I think I'm going to remember it like so happily. But when I've got a daughter who's 11, and me and my mum and my granny and my daughter went on quite a few holidays together. And I don't think a lot of people get that, like four generations of women going on holiday. It was amazing, and just sitting and, you know, having a brandy and milk or whatever, or a gin and tonic, if I still have a tonic, which might encourage alcoholism, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say that, but just the tonic. But the amount of comparisons that we could do in terms of what we've been told to hate, and especially stuff in the book, you know, if I thought, oh, it's really bad with periods now and hiding the tampon up my sleeve, I talk about, and then my gran talking about what she had to do and birth, and, you know, and sort of all having the same dreams. Like, I don't know about my daughter, she's young yet, but all the sort of desires in us to do with all the sexual stuff was quite similar, especially me and my mum's mum. You know, we sort of fancy the same people and find the same things quite a turn on, I think. But she just couldn't really do much with that, or she was, you know, shamed for it a lot more than I would be. So yeah, it was great. I've got, like, it's not at all the same, but I've got a very elderly neighbour who I have a cup of tea with each day normally, or a chat over the fence. And it's just sort of speaking to somebody. I don't think it has to be a grandparent. It's just speaking to somebody that's a different generation or two different generations to you. I think I just think it's really important. I think I learned more than from then than I did from probably from Cambridge, I'd say.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, that intergenerational thing, I just think it's something we don't value as much as we should. And whether it is an actual relative or whether it's just someone in your life that you know, like I've a few friends who have good friends who are much, much older than them. And I'm just always, I love those friendships. I think they're fascinating and important and rich and full of stuff. I want you to read a couple of poems for us because I can't have you on without doing that. And
oh,
the first one is about, tell me about this because you do have a lovely bit of prose before this particular poem. And it's from, I'm not sure which, is it the one, the granny you talk about sex with or the other granny?
The granny. Just
it's the random chat granny.
Yes, it's
tell us about this and then read us the poem.
Okay, so this poem is dedicated to my dad's mum. And my dad's side of the family is really obsessed with, it's not theft. I said that to my mum. She was like, do not call it theft. That makes us look terrible. But I think everyone has this in their family. So that just obsession with free testers in shops and also just taking as much free stuff as you can possibly get your hands on. So my gran definitely taught me this. And she used to just come. I remember when they came down from Scotland, her and my granddad and my auntie sometimes, they just used to have so many like sugar sachets from the train and that kind of thing. I had a lot of friends visited Scotland when I was younger and she used to take us just into the shops that had like the free tablet and the free tea. We'd go to church fetes just for the free scones. So yeah, it's about
and
that.
You know when you go into Marks and Spencer sometimes and they have someone making little sausages. I go around a few times, like you have to, and then you try to pretend haven't just been and then they look at you, but it's
so true. And I love that about being an adult. I love it. It's one of the best things, going with my daughter. And it's annoying that the posher the shop, the more free stuff you get, basically, and all the art galleries and stuff. But yeah, like Whittard's going in there and then we disguise ourselves, go in again, get as many like hot chocolate samples as possible. But yeah, so this poem's called The Day I Stopped Nicking Tea Bags from Hotels. And it was when I was on tour and I was sort of, I guess, bragging, though I don't like the word, but I guess it sort of was to another woman who was the support poet for this gig I was doing in York. And I said, oh, I've not bought any tea or sugar for like 2 months now because I've just been nicking them from hotels. And I thought this was like a massive, amazing thing to brag about, you know, how to make a friend. But she was a very good environmentalist and she just looked at me totally straight-faced and said, actually, that's really bad for the environment because the more people steal those little things, the more they're made and they're all like in plastic and it's really bad. And that was the response. I was like, oh, okay, great. So I've tried not to steal stuff. So this is my trauma of doing that. The day I stopped nicking tea bags from hotels, or granny, please forgive me. This is your fault, Granny, that I'm like this. I cannot leave the tiny shampoo bottle in the hotel shower, which I do not need to take. I do not need to take it. It will just sit in my bathroom cupboard unused for years, but I cannot leave it. Or the shower gel, or the body lotion. I don't even use body lotion. I've never used body lotion. This is your fault, Grandma. I cannot leave the tea bags in the basket for the next guest. I cannot leave the biscuits in the packets in the basket for the next guest. I cannot leave the alcohol in the glasses or the barrels or the bottles or all you can drink parties that you pay set fees in advance for. This is your fault, Grandma. That night, I ended up in a car park in a tutu, thinking the car park was my bedroom because I had to get my money's worth. You have to get your money's worth, Holly, at all you can drink pay in advance parties, which was only £5 to get into anyway. Don't worry, Grandma. I wasn't hurt. My friend found me, explained that the car park was not my flat, the car park space, not my bedroom, but Granny. Remember, you used to order 20 packs of sugars with your tea on the train down from Glasgow just so you could steal the packs of sugars with the excuse that they would have thrown them away anyway after being on your saucer. You never even ordered tea, just a mug of hot water and 20 packs of sugar slipped a tea bag from your handbag so you did not have to pay the full price for a cup of tea on the train. Today, I left a hotel room for the first time in my life without taking a single tea bag. Not one. You do not need the tea bag, Holly. You do not need the tea bag, Holly. The war is over. But now I'm on the train back home, staring out the window, and I can feel you on my shoulder, looking down on me, disgusted, frowning at the loss. What has happened to your family? What has happened to your grandchild? Whispering traitor, whispering traitor, whispering traitor.
Oh, Holly, that is brilliant.
Oh, thanks.
Like, seriously, you are amazing. And, you know, how you can bring us in to that whole thing. I mean, I totally relate. I rob a lot of things. So I'm sure everyone listening knows and has a granny or a relative like that, or is that person themselves. That was just extraordinary. At the back of your book, you thank the PN Review, which wrote a really horrible review of your poetry a few years ago. Why do you thank them?
Do you know, that is really interesting that you've said that, because I've actually taken it out in the proper version, so you've got a proof. And I thank them because I sort of wanted other people, if they'd had stuff like that, and I don't mean done to them, like part of that review I'm totally fine with. Genuinely, criticism I think is very important, and it's really nice as someone that's come through spoken word where everyone's just like, oh, I like that poem. You don't really get any critiquing of your work. So I really like that. But because part of that review, it was just really horrible. And I don't think it was okay. And I don't really think it should have been printed. So there was a lot in that that was just, it was sort of saying, if any audience member likes Holly's poetry, you're obviously ignorant. And often these reviews, they like to call on writers of the past and tell me how much writers of the past would have hated my poems. So I was sort of told that Schopenhauer and Hegel would have kind of argued about how awful I was. So I think a lot of the time we do that without, you know, you don't know that. I might have got on with Hegel very well, thank you very much. And I've had a similar one done recently about Keats, for Keats' anniversary. There was about how Keats would have turned in his grave at the state of modern poetry that we should just call rubbish. And I was used as one of the examples of that. And I think, again, you can't speak for Keats. Like, he would probably have been in the same poetry scene. I think a lot of poets actually get on really well with poets writing different sort of poetry to them. I don't think it's as divided as people make out. I think it's just in journalism, they often divide it, but the actual poets are getting on quite well, respecting each other quite a lot. So, yeah, I just wanted it to be like, it's all right if you get a terrible review. But then actually I thought, this is an acknowledgement of this book that I've worked really hard on. I actually don't want to put that in there and just keep back to it. But I do use some of the bad reviews for my tour posters, because some of the really bad ones are really amazing. Like, just how much people, it's not even hating the poetry, it's like, just hating me for writing it, or hating like Picador for publishing it, or whatever it is. So yeah, I think I wanted it in, and then I changed my mind. So yeah, it's interesting that you picked that up.
No, it is. I'm glad I asked you, even though, and it's good, because I think you're making very good points there. Now, you, along with the likes of Rupi Kaur and Kate Tempest, you've been kind of credited with, we talked about it earlier, making poetry a bit more accessible.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about your work that speaks to young women particularly? And do you think it's important that poetry, because there's some snobbery around, and I suppose you've alluded to that in the review. I mean, there's space for everything is what, yeah, I think. There's space for all kinds of books. There's space for all kinds of, totally, art. There's space for all kinds of music. What is this idea that it has to be only one type of thing? But where do you think you fit into all of that? And do you like being part of this kind of new poetry movement?
I'm not really sure what I think about it. To be honest, most of the time in the day, I'm too busy trying to like do my job and make dinner and look after my friends' kids and like arrange childcare or do the school run. So I do, don't get me wrong, I do think about it a bit, but sometimes the argument makes me sort of annoyed that I'm even spending any of my life thinking about what I think of poetry, because honestly, I really think there's a lot of very important things to be done in the world, and that's something, but not as big as maybe I want it to be in my head. I find it strange that it's always Rupi Kaur, not always, but a lot, Rupi Kaur, myself and Kay Tempest often are lumped together, and I think our poetry is really different, and I find it really weird. So every time that those three names are put together, it always makes me think, actually, this journalist hasn't really read a lot of it, really, because we all started out in different ways. Like, I think Rupi Kaur started out on Instagram. I started out, well, I guess we all started out writing, but Kay Tempest was very much kind of on stage and her. She's so inspired by a lot of the past writers that these articles say that she's never read and things. I just think that there's quite a lot of weak arguments involved in it.
No, I completely agree. And I mean, I think if anyone's listening who hasn't seen or read any of Kate Tempest or Rupi or yourself, and loads more, by the way, other people as well, they're so different.
Yeah.
That's the thing I'd say. But they're all, I think what you do, I do believe there might be a common thread in like, the ideas we have were told about poetry in school, which was a lot of, I think, nonsense a lot of the time. You yeah. three and many others at the moment are challenging that and are showing us the different ways words can be put together that can be equally moving, uplifting, challenging, thought-provoking, all of those things. Yeah. So
and I
perhaps that's the movement. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I don't like, I definitely don't. Like, this is not in a bad way, but I don't think Kay Tempest's poetry is that accessible in that way. I think it's very complicated and much more.
Some of it's less so.
And it is accessible, but I mean, in the sort of, I get called accessible sometimes in an insulting way by a lot of these reviews.
I think it's a compliment.
Yeah,
myself,
I think
sorry.
It's a. I find it weird that you know, all this venue is far too accessible for my liking. I find it like I try and compare it to stuff like that, you know. But actually, it's fine.
I hadn't thought of it like that.
And I know that's not saying. And I don't think all poetry should be accessible. Just like I don't think all, like you said, I don't think all painting should be. I think there's space for everything. And I find it strange that people get quite so annoyed about it. And I do think I like it though. I sort of was lumped into an article the other day about Insta poets. So I find it funny. Like every time I seem to share something on social media, people that are being positive sort of lump me in that, like, oh, YouTube poets are coming up. It's like, I mean, I'm reading from a book, but you're not calling me a book poet. I'm called a YouTuber. Yeah. And then
like if Martin Amis appears on YouTube, is he suddenly a YouTuber?
Totally.
You know,
I know Simon Armitage is on Instagram and he's really good on Instagram. So I really want an article to, you know, Insta poets that you've got to follow. Simon Armitage is on Instagram. Like, follow him. So
I think you should do that.
Yeah.
Now, listen, we haven't really spoken much. We started at the beginning about talking about women's bodies and pinky gloves, which I know you're going to go off and research now after this interview.
So
pinky gloves. Let's go back to that, because a lot of your work is so brilliant on women's experiences, let's call it, rather than women's issues, or just living the life of a woman, parenthood, you know, sexuality. I mean, the masturbation stuff that you have in there, we could talk all day about that, because I think there's one part where you're talking about this idea of losing your virginity as if sex is only penetration from a penis, you know, as if there isn't so many other glorious ways to explore sex and some of them on your own.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
The best way, like you say, can't hurt anyone. And there's no consent issues. It's just
so
you.
So safe and so cheap.
Yeah, so safe and cheap. So with that being said, would you read the poem, which has got a brilliant title, When I Am Dead, Will You Finally Shut the Fuck Up? Because I think it encompasses a lot of your worldview, let's say, and why your work, I think, is so important. And I'll certainly, I have two 11-year-old daughters, and when they get a little bit older, I'll need to leave it a few years. But yeah. Like your book is something I'd want them to read, because I think it'll be an education and a liberation for them. And it will hopefully by then confirm stuff that they already know, but just allow them to be in a world where we don't have to feel queasy and squeamish about all this stuff.
Thanks a lot. My daughter's 11 too, and I'm also not letting her read it yet. Or maybe ever, because it's her mum, so it's a bit weird and different. When I am dead, will you finally shut the fuck up? When I was a teenage girl, the newspapers printed stories about monsters they called paedophiles. When I was a teenage girl, a special assembly was called, which told us all to watch out for a man flashing his penis in the park near the school. We all thought it was funny. Walked there especially, looked out for the long coat, pointed with our friends. When I was a teenage girl, one newspaper printed a list of home addresses of people they called paedophiles, vigilante justice and one count of linguistic ignorance graffitiing the walls of a paediatrician's home. When I was a teenage girl, I bought a top 10 record by another teenage girl dancing in school uniform like mine. She sang Hit Me Baby one more time. I sang Hit Me Baby one more time, not wondering whether the clever chorus line referred to punching or being fucked hard or replaying a record. When I was a teenage girl, my friend was called a slag for owning a vibrator. When I was a teenage girl, my friend was called a prude for not getting fingered. When I was a teenage girl, the front cover of this album had Britney Spears in pigtails, looking up at a camera, as virgin as could be. I did not wonder who directed it. When I was a teenage girl, my friend told everyone he had fingered me in the garden at a house party that weekend when really he was crying about a problem in his family. He apologised at school. I agreed not to tell the truth. We stayed close friends. When I was a teenage girl, I opened the CD in my bedroom, a poster folded up inside to put up on my wall. It had Britney, dressed in a virgin white vest top, with virgin white teeth, sat astride a chair, legs parted for the camera, camera zoomed onto her schoolgirl crotch. When I was a teenage girl, I was told not to use a tampon when I was bleeding playing sport because that would be like losing my virginity to a tampon before I'd had a dick in me. I was told not to put a dick in me. I was told the only sex that counted was sex with a dick in me. When I was a teenage girl, two teenage girls in a Russian pop video were directed to snog each other in school uniform like mine, looking sexy at the camera, singing all the things she said, all the things she said, running through my head, running through my head. When I was a teenage girl, I was told off for wearing a skirt too short for school. I rolled it down each lesson, rolled it up each break. When I was a teenage girl, I was told I could not play in the tennis team unless I wore the match kit. Match kit was a short white skirt. I was on my period. I did not use a tampon yet because that would be like ruining my pussy before I'd had a dick in me. Sanitary towels leaked a lot. I learnt how to check for bloodstains between backhand lobs. When I was a teenage girl, I was told not to risk the shortcut. I was told not to walk alone. I was told not to stay out late. I was told not to masturbate. I was told not to get pregnant. I was told not to get fingered. I was told not to be too sexy. I was told not to not be sexy. I was told to sing, "Hit me, baby. Hit me, baby. Hit me, baby. One more time in a uniform like hers." I was told all the things she said, all the things she said, running through my head, running through my head. When I was in my 20s, I fed my baby in the toilet for fear of looking like I was sort of trying to look sexy. I'm still not sure exactly why I was embarrassed to feed a baby with my body, but I was. When I was 30, my friend organised a Botox party before we went on holiday because apparently when you are 30, laughter is less attractive. When I was 35, I was told not to wear a vest top because women my age do not show our arms now for fear of bats apparently landing on the skin below. When I was 40, I was told my sex drive would dry up with my bleeding, but no one talks about the menopause. When I was 50, I was told. When I was 60, when I was 70, when I was 80, I was told, I am hoping this will stop. But my grandma is 92 and she is on a diet because in our family, as I've been told my entire life long, the women in our family have bad stomachs. Hold it in, Holly. Hold it in, Holly. Hold it in, Holly. When I'm dead, I am hoping I can stretch out in my coffin, silence in my bones.
It's just great hearing you read it. You're a very talented person and I'm so glad that you're writing poetry and also prose because that's also fantastic. And like we didn't really go into the sort of what inspired that poem at the beginning. And in a way, it's great because people can get the book and they can read that part too. But there's a really interesting lead into the poem. But just fantastic. I know that everyone listening is just going to be cheering wherever they are on their walks or their in their kitchens. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I was thinking if my mum's listening, she'll be like, "Why do you have to say the word pussy?" That is, she will not be cheering.
If you're listening, she's still in Bucklebury.
Between there and Scotland, yeah, there in Glasgow.
And where are you now, Holly, before we say goodbye?
I'm based just north of Cambridge, so between there and Glasgow as well.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, the best of luck with it. We hope you'll come back on the podcast sometime again because you've got the next book coming out. Is it next year? Or
I think so, yeah. the next half. It's more uplifting and less moany, I'd say, the next one.
Well, I don't care. I'd read anything you write. You're just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And thanks so much for giving us so much time and the best of luck with everything. I haven't even asked you about the pandemic. That's the obligatory question. You can give us a quick response to how it's kind of, I mean, performing is a big part of your work. So it must have, you know, like for any artist, it's been very disrupting.
Yeah, it has been. But I have been all right, not feeling vomit nervous for a year. Because I always do before I go on. So that has been all right. But the pandemic in general has been a bit rubbish.
Yeah. COVID silver lining there. Holly McNish, thanks so much for joining us.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
And that was Holly McNish. I really recommend that book. It's brilliant, not like any poetry book you've ever read. But that's it for today. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, by Jennifer Ryan and Suzanne Brennan, with JJ Vernon on sound. Remember, you can get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast, or email us with suggestions of issues we should be covering. And that address for email is thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. Mind yourselves, haircuts and hugs this week. I hope you enjoy yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.